The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR, and I'm Virginia Prescott. How much money you make determines a lot about your lifestyle, where you live, and what you do when the check arrives for dinner.
Who's been here? You got one bill, multiple people, a wage gap plaguing women and minorities, plus Molly drank most of the wine. That's why I created Equitable. Splits bills fairly. No, really, fairly.
Equitable is and that's the voice of Luna Malbro, a San Francisco-based comedian and the driving force behind Equitable. It's an app designed to split restaurant bills by inequality of wages based on gender and race. And Luna is on the line to tell us how it works. Luna, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I have to admit, Luna, when I saw this video, I really thought it was a joke.
First of all, it is a joke. It is actually, you know, Equitable is a comedic app that was created out of Comedy Hack Day, a competition that brings comedians and techies together. And so I created this comedically as a way to humorously explore the wage gap. And what happened was it actually inspired the creation of a real app that people can use. And if you move through the app, you'll see that we still have humorous commentary throughout it as it actually calculates what you should pay.
It is really something. So you've kind of got the elephant at the table, right? You know, when you're sitting there with a bunch of people of different ethnicities, different genders, can you give us a little rundown on how you calculate how much of the bill they're supposed to pay based on who they are?
Absolutely. So we use the Bureau of Labor Statistics on how much people make per year. So it includes the average amount that people make depending on race and gender, because that's something that's often left out of the wage gap. When you hear people talk about it, you often hear women make 79 cents of the dollar, but that's different for people of color and across different races. So we actually pull Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the latest that we have is from the year 2014. And for instance, Latino women make 54 cents to the dollar for every U.S. white male. So what we do is, you know, in splitting the bill, a Latino woman would pay only 54 cents on her half or her portion of the bill. And then we adjust throughout the bill for everyone else to either pay a little bit more, a little less, depending on how much they're making.
So white males pay the highest share?
Actually not. Based on the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Asian men actually make the most per year. They make $1,000 in weekly earnings compared to the white males roughly around $900. So actually with Equitable, Asian men pay the most within the app based on those pure statistics.
So that's $1.20 to a white man's dollar?
Exactly.
So the app actually prompts you to make a profile, including name, race, gender, and gender is on a scale. How is that graded?
Well, we just wanted to really represent that we, as the Equitable team, see gender on a spectrum, and it's not binary, and there are some people who identify as male and some people who identify as female and some people who identify as neither. So we really created a spectrum within the app where, depending on where you are on the spectrum, there's actually a third gender that we calculated for, which is an average of the two genders. Because there's not that much research out right now about how non-gendered people or even trans people, what they're getting paid kind of factors into discrimination. So we're lacking that research, but the team really wanted to at least acknowledge that exists and that discrimination based on gender and non-conforming gender exists as well. So we just added a third gender to represent that.
So here in New Hampshire, we don't have a very ethnically or racially diverse population, but certainly a lot of wage inequity. Is there a profile just based straight on how much or how little one makes?
Right. Well, that's a great question. That's a question we always get. And we do not have one based on how much one makes or how little one makes, but there's been talk about in other updated versions being able to add that in as well. However, I think that that always kind of detracts away from the point. The point is not necessarily based on just how much you make, but really a system of inequality that's based on discrimination based on race and gender. And I'm sure even though you may have not a diversity of demographics among race, you still have discrimination towards women based on, you know, their gender and their identity. I'm pretty sure, like I've seen the statistics, it's pretty much the same in every state. Louisiana is actually the worst when it comes to gender discrimination, but wherever you go, women are getting paid less for the same job compared to men.
Which is funny because it puts us in this kind of retro position of saying, like, well, I'm the woman, so I should pay less.
Exactly. Well, there's that too. But actually the point of it is not necessarily saying I should pay less. It's not, you know, I think a lot of people are just saying, like, oh, we want people to get a hand out or something like that. But it's really the point is to kind of incentivize people to actually create progress. Because could you imagine if this app were a little bit more serious and real and men were forced to actually pay more? I think there would be a lot more incentive to make sure that things were more equal, that there would be less bias at the job and less bias when it comes to how people are being paid, because you're going to be penalized for it, essentially. So really, when I created the joke, it was all about taking the idea of equity to the extreme and creating a new way of challenging the wage gap. So instead of asking people to pay you fairly, you're creating incentives for people to do so.
Well, it is very funny. I mean, you call it affirmative fractions.
Exactly.
Reparations one meal at a time. How does having a sense of humor play into bringing attention to these issues?
Well, I think it was really the humor that allowed us to kind of explore a lot of different things within the app and talk about a lot of things. And I think I think humor is important because it's, people are able to drop their defenses a little bit, and it's entertaining, it's funny, and I think that makes it more engaging. And so you're able to engage with an idea in a different way than if I were to just stand on a podium and lecture people about the wage gap, right? So I think humor makes it a little bit more relatable to people.
There's also a protest feature on the app. Now, what is that?
So we, in creating the app, again, with the humor, had also imagined that people would be pretty upset about that, even just the idea of it. And we, you know, we look at the news and we hear a lot of the rhetoric, the anti-wage gap rhetoric. So we wanted to just cut to the chase and just build those protests within the app so people can just go ahead and put those excuses in for why they wouldn't like the app. And we actually opened responses to that as well. You know, things and phrases such as, I pulled myself up from my bootstraps, which you hear, or this is not an issue anymore. We comically address that within the app.
How?
So we have a curated list of most common objections, and some of them are humorous as well. Like one of them is, I was a middle child, or I'm conventionally unattractive. And depending on which one you choose, we have different response to them. My favorite, I pulled myself up from your bootstraps, is met with, your boots were made by child labor. So obviously it's humorous, but it's very tongue-in-cheek. And then for this is not an issue anymore, we actually break down the statistics of weekly earnings for women, and specifically women of color, such as Black women and Latino women.
So the one thing I think about this is that people having dinner together are always going to be aware of a kind of hierarchy, of an inequity. What do you think of that? Is that the right thing to bring to the dinner table?
I think for many people, they're constantly aware of it. I'm a Black woman, and it's something that I never forget. Especially as I move around this world, I see discrimination. I face discrimination, and I have the lived experience of being Black and feeling that and having those things come up against me. So it's something that I always have to think about. And so I think what it does is raise awareness for people who may not have to think about it all the time.
What's your goal, Luna, to actually see the app used or just continue raising awareness about this?
Well, both. I think I would love to continue raising awareness through the app. And, you know, people always tell me, do you think people should use it to split the bill? And I think people should use it as a conversation starter. Have fun and engage with different friends and learn more about the issue. We actually have a donate link within the app that if you are a homogeneous group, you have the opportunity to kind of give back. And so we link to the American Association of University Women, who do a lot of work on this issue, and they have a lot of information about it as well. And so ultimately, the goal is to entertain and educate.
Luna Malbro, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia. Great talking to you.
Luna Malbro, she's a San Francisco-based comedian. With her master's from Columbia University in clinical social work, she is the force behind the new app Equitable. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When I was growing up, eggs were eggs, packed by the dozen in mostly styrofoam cartons. And aside from checking for cracks, consumers weren't all that picky about what they were taking home. Walk into a grocery store today, and the choices can be a little overwhelming.
So let's see. I've got farm fresh, cage-free, all-natural eggs, vegetarian-fed hens. These ones are organic. Large brown eggs, jumbo eggs. No added antibiotics or hormones. No added animal fat. These both say organic, but they're certified by different groups.
Sure, if price is your only consideration, there's still a plain cardboard carton of eggs that makes no claims to be anything special. That's usually the cheapest. But if you, like lots of consumers today, are concerned not just about the taste of an egg, but for the welfare of the animal that laid it, then there are many more options to consider. Gabrielle Salisbury is an assistant editor at Modern Farmer, where she wrote a comprehensive guide to navigating grocery store eggs. Gabby spoke with senior producer Taylor Quimby.
What are we getting when you buy something that doesn't claim to be anything more than a carton of eggs?
Well, if you're getting something that doesn't claim something else, it doesn't claim cage-free or free-range or pasture-raised, then likely it's conventional eggs.
Although a number of farms and companies are moving away from conventional egg production, notably McDonald's, which promises to go cage-free by 2025. Most grocery store eggs still come from conventional farms.
And a lot of these conventional farms have things called battery cages, which are teeny cages that the laying hens live in and lay their eggs. A lot of these cages don't have enough area for the birds to even turn around.
The allowable size for battery cages is about half a square foot, which you can think of as about the size of a standard sheet of paper. Now, if that freaks you out, there are a lot of other options, but some are not all they're cracked up to be.
What are the things that sound good but mean absolutely nothing?
One of the things that you'll see on cartons a lot is just the phrase all natural. If it's natural, it means it was laid by a hen.
Like it's not so, made by a mutant. It's not made by a robot
right.
Chicken.
Right. Didn't come from an alien.
Another couple of phrases that has more to do with marketing than reality, farm fresh. And maybe the most misleading, hormone-free.
No hormones, which I always thought sounded really great and really sexy. It's not incorrect, but the USDA bans hormone use in egg-laying hens. So buying something because it says it's no hormones is just patting the company on the back for following the rules that they have to follow anyway.
Okay, so let's talk about the labels that are not so gimmicky. These are the ones you've probably seen or heard more about over the past few years, and which usually cost a little bit more than the plain old cardboard cartons.
A cage-free environment is exactly what it sounds like. They can be in rooms and never see the light of day, but they aren't in cages. Free range is a little bit better. For the USDA Agricultural Marketing Service to allow something to be called free-range, they have to have access to the outdoors. Now, they can have access, but never actually be able to go outside. You know, they can have a door, but the door might never open.
That is some dystopian BS right there.
I know. It's really, really crazy. I was a little bummed finding out all this stuff.
Yeah. And then there's the USDA Organic Program, which does have some strict rules about chicken feed, but like cage-free and free-range, USDA Organic is not clear on exactly how much space a chicken needs to have or how often they're allowed to go outside. Now, this does not mean that all farms are parsing their words and twisting their mustaches as they print misleading labels for their eggs. It's just that there are a lot of loopholes, and when you're at the grocery store, you can't always know what you're getting, which is true of a lot of products. So for purists, who only want eggs from happy chickens raised on idyllic small farm operations, there are a couple of independent certifications to look for.
Animal welfare approved, certified humane, they have the most stringent requirements. Cage-free birds are kept indoors, but they're required to have nesting and perching opportunities, which are natural habits of chickens. Free range in certified humane requires outdoor access for 6 hours a day and 2 square feet of outdoor space per chicken. So, you know, they have like a little room to play. And then pasture raised under the certified humane label requires 2.5 acres of pasture per 1,000 hens per day. And they have to be on pasture that has living vegetation for them to forage.
Gabby points out that getting animal welfare or certified humane on your carton does not cost producers money, whereas applying for USDA organic certification is a long and pricey process. Luckily, we're in New England, where the whole label problem could be solved by doing a little detective work.
So your neighborhood farm, you know, down the street from you, might not have time to apply for the certified humane or the American welfare or animal welfare approved. But if you do have a farm down the street, you can go and chat with your farmer and see how he or she raises their animals and sort of vet it for yourself.
All right, we've addressed some of the big questions, but there's a lot more to know about the egg buying process. You can check out a link to Gabrielle Salisbury's super helpful guide to grocery store eggs in New Hampshire. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can also learn the answer to questions like, what does a double A grade mean? How large does an egg have to be considered extra large? And we'll give you this one as a bonus. Why are some eggs brown and some white?
It relates to the color of the hen's earlobes. So there are some hens that have white earlobes that lay white eggs and some that have red earlobes that lay brown eggs. So it's not the same, but it's related.
That is weird.
Yeah.
It's all in the earlobes. Who knew? Before we move on, we wanted to ask about another controversial egg-related topic that was dividing the staff here at Word of Mouth. Which do you prefer, a runny yolk or one cooked all the way through? Well, if you're wondering where we stand, we asked our two most opposed team members to have a little debate on this subject, starting with executive producer Maureen McMurray, who, as you will hear, is strongly opposed to an egg over easy.
First of all, runny eggs are a gross consistency. They are mucousy. They're disgusting. They make bread soggy. Toast is supposed to be crisp. And then when you sop, I can't even think about it because it's so disgusting. When you sop up the runny eggs, it makes it all soggy. And not to mention the fact that they carry disease. If they're raw, if they're undercooked, you could get salmonella poisoning, I think. I might be thinking of chickens. I don't know. We need to fact check that. Either way, they're gross. Fluffy eggs are delicious. They're just better and all around they're good for the country. Make America great again.
Okay, so now we've heard the against runny eggs. We're now going to turn to Molly Donahue, who is going to plead the case for runny eggs.
Runny eggs are the best. You can soak up all your super dry toast in them. It's warm. It's delicious. It's like an extra condiment that comes with your breakfast. And besides, if you're eating eggs over hard or fried eggs, the yolk gets all dry and crumbly, and that's gross to deal with. And it's just like an extra special treat every breakfast time.
What about the salmonella?
It's getting cooked. It's not like you're being given an uncooked egg.
We're going to say over medium. It's over an over medium egg.
What about the consistency? And then when the egg gets on your other...
Consistency is great. It's like ketchup. Syrup, Maureen. It's like savory syrup.
But wait. Then when it runs into the other stuff, like your hash browns, it's so nasty.
Okay, we don't have time for the full Q&A section of this debate. We're going to throw this to our listeners.
Okay, listeners, here's the question. Runny yolks, disgusting or delicious for dipping? You can take our poll and vote for your preferred yolk on Twitter. Our handle is @wordofmouth. Or feel free to troll our Facebook page with your opinion. Sometimes you just have to take a stand. That's at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At 30, Jessa Crispin was living in Chicago, running a respected literary magazine, and on the edge of suicide. A friend she confided in was worried enough to call for help, and it arrived. Two police officers ready to take her to the ER. Jessa lies, assures the cops that a friend is coming, and tries to shoo them out of her kitchen, where a pot of orange mac and cheese from a box sits on the stove. She feels ashamed, more exposed by her meal than the reason they were called. This was not the life Jessa Crispin wanted, but how to change it? For guides, she looked to the dead. The writers and artists and composers who kept me company in the late hours of the night, she writes. I needed to know how they did it. So she gets rid of her stuff, packs two bags, and begins a pilgrimage of sorts. Her book, The Dead Ladies Project, Exiles, Expats, and Ex-Countries, is her account of following what she calls the unloosed, the wandering souls, who are willing to scrape their lives clean and start again elsewhere. And Jessa is founder of the literary magazines Book Slut and Spolia. And she joins us now from Vancouver. Jessa Crispin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So there was that moment of realization in your kitchen with those cops. Besides the mac and cheese, what to your mind just had to change?
Oh, everything. And I think that's why it was so terrifying. There just seemed so little from the life that I was leading that I wanted to keep. But it's really overwhelming to make a dramatic change like that. And I had no idea how to go about it.
So you blow it all up and you take off without a safety net to follow your dead guides. They're not all ladies, by the way. William James, Maud Gonne, Rebecca West, Igor Stravinsky, Somerset Maugham among them. In places where they were living as exiles. So what is it about the exile that is so appealing to you?
Well, it's the feeling of not belonging. It's the feeling of alienation and dealing with it, using it to be productive rather than just sort of using it as an excuse not to do anything. I'd always felt very alienated from where I was. I was born in Kansas in a very small town in a very kind of, you know, conservative, controlling family. And so I never felt like I belonged anywhere, which causes a lot of pain. But then eventually you kind of figure, or you can figure, I don't belong anywhere, so why not just go everywhere?
So you begin in Berlin on the trail of William James. Why there and why him?
Well, Berlin has always been that place where you go when you run out of options, right? I mean, it's David Bowie went there, William James went there, Nick Cave went there, and it's always at this kind of nadir, basically, when you have just no idea what else to do. And Berlin has, you know, historically as well as personally, provided this kind of rebirth process, you know, for Germany and then for the musicians and the artists who have gone there. And so I just figured, well, I'll just do it. Those people are smarter than me, so I'll just do what they did.
You realize that there's this need for a new story, and this is something you recognize in Maud Gonne, the statuesque actress who is known as the obsession and muse of William Butler Yeats, a revolutionary for the Irish cause. After a couple of cities, you go to Dublin. And so what did your time in Dublin reveal to you about her story?
Well, she was kind of this interesting figure in that she actively created her own myth. There's this story that she provides in her autobiography, which is that she's Irish. She's not Irish. She's British. She leaves out kind of everything that's interesting about her, including the fact that she was a black magician. who, you know, resurrected her dead son into a new pregnancy. But she leaves all that out because it didn't really fit in with the myth of her. So there are all these different versions of her. It was just sort of like, well, what's the story of your life? Well, it's not just one story. It's 80 different stories. And there's the myth of it, and then there's the things that actually happen. She was really interesting as far as just figuring out, you can present yourself one way, but your life is actually really messy and weird and violent sometimes. But that doesn't negate the good of your life.
And also realizing that for the revolution, they needed more than just guns. They needed new stories. They needed a new narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're in a crisis, you need a new story to tell yourself. And that is for countries, and that's for people individually. In order to make a big change, you have to change the story of your life. Because if the story of your life is that, oh, I'm a failure, or, oh, I'm, you know, like I'm the daughter of the patriarch, or, you know, whatever. If you stick with that story, the changes are always just going to come back to that. You can try to make a big change, but you're always going to come back to that story. But if you tell yourself a new story about yourself, or about your country, or about your gender, or whatever, then you can kind of aspire to it. You can move your way through changes just by changing the story that you tell.
It also discounts the role of the people around you. And I'm thinking right now of Nora Barnacle, wife of James Joyce. You followed their trail to Trieste, Italy. You point out that most biographers have disdain for artists' wives, and they dismiss her as uninteresting. What did you think? What did you discover about her life?
She was, I think that the disdain, particularly for Nora Barnacle, was that she married him before he was a genius, right? So it was just a, like a man marrying a woman. And so she was, you know, a commoner. She came from the west of Ireland. She was very sort of unglamorous. And people saw her as particularly boring and unworthy of such a great man, right? But in fact, he was completely inspired by her constantly, the way the language that she used, the stories that she told. Without her, there was no him. His books would have been completely different. Most of his female characters are based on her. But we don't like that. You know, we like to think of our geniuses as being these self-contained units, and we don't like the wives because the wives ground them into a daily life. They require money, they require attention, they take them away from, you know, the art.
Well, this is so interesting because running alongside your dead ladies, dead artist pilgrimage is your own relationship with a man you refer to in the book only as the lover. And you are technically his mistress, as he is still technically married. Nora Barnacle's experience brings up this question of who you would rather be, the wife or the mistress. And you choose mistress. So what comes with that choice?
Well, way more freedom. to just, you know, to leave. If you're the mistress, then you can get on a plane and not have to check with anybody. But at the same time, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anxiety, a lot of, you know, sense of why am I not good enough to be the wife? There really is not, and I think this is slowly changing, but there isn't a kind of space for the spinster, right? Mm. For the independent woman who does whatever she wants to do. We still define ourselves based on what our relationship is to a man. We don't do this to men, of course. But if you are a woman and say a newspaper is writing your obituary, and the first sentence is going to be who you mothered and who you married. Mm. And that's how we define our women. So with the mistress, you do get a little bit more independence. You get some distance from that. You don't have to worry about defining yourself through somebody else. But at the same time, you know, it's not a super great position to be in morally or emotionally.
We're speaking with Jessa Crispin. Her new book is called The Dead Ladies Project. It's kind of a travelogue of her pilgrimage following the dead, the artists who have inspired her and, as she says, kept her company in the late hours of the night to figure out how to live, how to get herself out of an emotional crisis. Well, how artists make work comes back over and over again in this book, and you connect very powerfully, I think, with the spirit of Stravinsky in Lausanne, Switzerland. It's a period of his life that has been written about quite a bit, you point out. But there's this kind of idea that, you know, when you're kind of backed up against the wall, when you're separate from everything, when you have to start from scratch, that's where the creativity comes. Do you think that's true?
I do. I think that comfort is in a lot of ways the enemy of creativity. Security and predictability, routine, these things stifle the creative impulse, because in order to create something new, you have to be able to look at the world in a new way. And he had been producing ballets with Diaghilev in the Ballet Russe, but then he found himself in this situation in Switzerland where he was waiting out World War I, where he didn't have an orchestra. There was no orchestra. You can't write a symphony if you don't have a string section. But there were kind of ragtag people around. You know, he could assemble about 15 musicians who weren't off to war. And he was like, all right, well, let's just work with this. But I think it takes like a huge amount of optimism not to fall into the disappointment of like, I want everything to be perfect. You know, I need 89 different instruments in order to really, bring my vision to life. And he was just like, well, we'll work with what we have. And I really admire that about him.
In your search, in your travels, I mean, you obviously chose places to go and artists that you might follow, but were there any great surprises to you, any great discoveries about people and why they did the work or had the ambition or spawned the creativity that they had?
I think the big surprise was that everybody was just a person. Creating art is just trying and failing and trying and failing. And, you know, no one is ever like, there are a couple, you know, dudes who do this, but, you know, I'm a genius. I've created perfection. No one actually thinks that way. It's always trying things, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, and starting again the next day. And I think that was the biggest revelation to me, is like, oh, no, that's what I do. Maybe I'm a writer.
Huh. Well, you know, after, you know, being embarrassed about that orange mac and cheese stuff that comes from a box, you put an awful lot out there. You know, about your own tensions, your own questions about your life, this fantasy of a settled life, what that looks like with a man, and the freedom of constant motion, all the things that come with it. So looks pretty pale, the mac and cheese in comparison. How are you living with that?
I think it's just, we all get to low points. I don't think that there's any point in trying to present yourself as more together than you actually are. I don't think there's much value in pretending that you're super great all of the time. I went through a dark period, but it was still an interesting time in my life. I was running my own literary magazine. I was traveling. I was having a good time. If I hadn't gone through that, then I would not have moved to Berlin, absolutely, and had all these adventures. So I have no problem with my past or talking about it.
You were in total, I think, 5 years on the road. How about now? You know, where's home? Is there a home? Is there a bag packed under the bed ready to go?
There's always a bag. There's always a bag by the door. I like to say that I don't necessarily have a house, but my books have a house now, and sometimes I go and visit them.
Well, Jessa Crispin, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jessa Crispin, she's founder of the literary magazine Book Slut and Spolia, and author of the book The Dead Ladies Project: Exiles, Expats, and Ex-Countries. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. Thank you. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Scientists are sometimes typecast as left-brained eggheads with little use for the arts. Physicist Michael Solomon takes issue with that. He argues that the work of poet Walt Whitman perpetuates that myth of the scientist, unable to appreciate art or beauty, while Solomon finds exactly the opposite to be true. Producer Lou Okolsky brings us his story.
When Michael Solomon was young, a close friend of the family moved into his home in Brooklyn. This family friend had a unique combination of qualities. He was a poet who translated Federico Garcia Lorca, and he'd spent time in the USSR studying their early space program.
And he would sit by my bed and tell me stories about space. And I think in some way he was the primal influence in my life in this regard. I mean, I always had space in my mind.
Michael was a scientifically inclined kid growing up in a literary household. His mother worked on the editorial staff at a New York publishing house, so he grew up to be very well-read, comfortable with all kinds of literature. He can't remember when exactly he first read Walt Whitman's passage, "I Heard the Learned Astronomer," from Leaves of Grass.
It says, "When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the pictures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer, where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars." I've always been bothered by this poem. I mean, it's a beautiful poem, I love it, but he just didn't get it at all. He had it all wrong. It's beautiful. It's not dry and ugly.
Michael couldn't understand why Whitman, who was otherwise pretty effusive about damn near everything, would make such a sweeping criticism of astronomy and astronomers.
I was a budding scientist, and here's someone who's basically saying, you know, science is dry, and, you know, how much more beautiful to just go out and observe mystically, in perfect silence, looking at the stars. I mean, we all respond to beauty. I mean, of course, it's a beautiful night. You breathe the night air. You look at the full moon. You see Mars, a little pink dot in the sky. You know, you see Betelgeuse, you know, the big red giant in the arm of Orion. Yeah, of course, you know, it's beautiful.
But for Michael, it's even more beautiful when you understand the physics that make it all possible. The first time he really got how beautiful science could be, Michael was a freshman at MIT.
And I was struggling to understand Maxwell's equations, which are the classical equations of electrodynamics. It explains the existence of light. It also explains magnetism or static electricity. Why electrons circle the nuclei of atoms. He took all of these observed phenomena and in just four equations expressed it all. So I remember I was listening to Janis Joplin at the time. I was not stoned. I was trying to penetrate and really visualize what these things were saying. I spent several hours just hard thinking. I was kept on saying, "I don't get it, I don't get it." In order to do it, I actually have to let my mind sink for hours. And as I go deeper and deeper and deeper, other things are pushed out. It's almost like meditating, except you're deeply thinking hard. And finally, after hours of concentrated thought, you sort of come out of this trance. And suddenly, it all fits and it just exploded. It was there, and it was rock solid. And it was beautiful. It was so beautiful. It's sort of like the first time you have your first sexual experience, and it's like, oh my God, that's amazing. You know, I want more, please. So, you know, the dry figures and the calculations, the stuff that Walt Whitman is talking about here, they're all pathways to experience of beauty. in a manner that not everyone is blessed to have, as we are, as physicists are, I think.
Of course, when Whitman wrote his poem in 1871, it was still early in the study of physics. But William Blake, writing even earlier, managed to capture an appreciation of fundamentals.
A little thing, a little ditty from William Blake. It's very famous. To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. I just love that. And, you know, if you take a look at a grain of sand, what is sand? Sand is silicon dioxide, and there are atoms involved, and there are electrons, you know. And why do you have grain structure? And if you really want to understand this grain of sand, you have to get into the atomic physics and the nuclear physics. It's all there. All of physics is in this grain of sand, or almost all of physics is in this grain of sand. So to see the universe in a grain of sand, it's very beautiful.
Michael knows Blake never intended to celebrate physics, but for the most part, the passage still works for him.
Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Frankly, I don't believe in infinity. It's a beautiful concept, though.
A Whitman scholar would tell you that Walt Whitman actually loved new technology and feats of engineering. So it wouldn't be too difficult to imagine Walt hanging out with Michael, listening to Janis Joplin, and trying to match Michael's mind-blowing experience with Maxwell's equations.
And if I had Walt Whitman here, I would turn him around, no question about it. He would rewrite his poem at the end of the day.
And our thanks to Lou Okulski for that story.
I went to a very liberal arts college, and it was one of those colleges that was all about, we produce well-rounded adults. Our English majors take science classes. Our science majors take English classes. We produce real human beings. So I was an English major, and I had to take a science class. So, and by the way, my knowledge of science to this day goes no further than salt is salty. There, that's it. That's it. That's all I know. So they had a class at my college, and I'm not making this up. It was called Physics for Poets. Hey there, theater f***s and English put on some pantaloons and a scarf and take a bracing shot of absinthe and skip on down through a field of gillyflowers to the physics department, where we'll teach you about the music of the spheres without using any scary numbers. And you can ask questions like, is the red planet Mercury like the crimson eye of Cerberus?
Thank you for taking some time with us today. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or on Audioboom or Stitcher. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. That'll help others find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.